You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid access, which cost the government billions. We'll talk to a researcher who says that move helped lower costs in other areas.
First, we're talking about the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. White supremacists and others gathered for a so-called Unite the Right march in Charlottesville on Saturday. Counter-protesters also turned out, and taunting led to shoving, and after that, to violence. Then a car plowed into a group of counter-protesters, leaving one woman dead and 19 others injured. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe declared a state of emergency. In total, at least 34 people were injured in the clashes.
We want to hear what you think about the news now at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to what happened over the weekend? What did you make of the president's response both today and over the weekend? What kind of action do you think should be taken in the face of the next white supremacist rally? And what would you like to see, if anything, from the federal government? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and a professor of race relations at Westchester University. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I want to start today with audio of some of the chanting from the white supremacists and others from Friday night as they marched through the University of Virginia campus.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
You will not replace us! You will not replace us is the chant. What do you make of that chant? What is the meaning behind it?
I think the meaning of this is individuals who are somewhat anxious and really afraid and fearful that as we move forward in our democracy, we're talking about the browning of America and that the world may become a little bit more browner and a little bit more equitable. And so the "you will not replace us" is a fear that some whites have that whites will one day be in the minority.
Well, we are, as you said, at this juncture in history when the majority are becoming the minority, looking at the browning of America. And how do you think we can, as a country, face moments like this and make that reaction and that transition constructive and not like it was on Saturday, not destructive?
I think we're just going to have more whites of racial consciousness who can speak back to this in a nonviolent way. Janet Helms talks often about white identity development or white identity models. And the white identity model has to be rooted in white pride, but not from a superiority standpoint, but to be proud to be white. But in a society that oftentimes benefits from white privilege, oftentimes whites have a strong ethnic identity, but they don't have a strong racial identity. So I think just having more conversations around racial identity, but I'm not saying that that's the panacea. We have some deeply rooted problems in our democracy.
I think that some people would hear you say white identity model and even the notion that it's okay to embrace that on some levels, certainly not all, but on some levels would recoil from that because it seems to have with it this history that we saw manifested on Saturday of intolerance sometimes and racism.
Yeah, certainly. When we talk about Asian pride, African-American pride, Latino pride, Jewish pride, it's not rooted in superiority, and is also not rooted in inferiority. But there are ways that we can talk about those white abolitionists like John Brown, those white civil rights leaders during Martin Luther King and others' era who actually fought for black humanity and all humanity. And so you're absolutely right. What we saw in Charlottesville is not the reality of what I'm talking about as it relates to white pride. Sometimes people want to be on one side or the other, and they fail to realize that there are ways that we can speak back to this, and we need to also make sure that we hold ourselves accountable and that we're not lending to more of these type of behaviors as well by race baiting.
I want to talk a little bit about the reaction of President Trump. He on Saturday had this to say.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country.
He said on many sides, and that was the language that earned him a lot of criticism. And on this Monday afternoon, he said this.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
So a much more pointed rebuke in that second clip. Chad, what do you hear when you hear those two responses from the President of the United States back to back?
I don't view either of the clips as having any authenticity. It didn't come from his belly. It didn't come from his soul, similar to what we heard Marco Rubio articulate, what John McCain articulated, and what the governor of Virginia articulated. This is a president who oftentimes provides some of the same chants that we heard, some of the same xenophobic, some of the same racist, some of the same homophobic language. And so white supremacists, they feel emboldened by a president that does not condemn them. And now that it's gotten away from him, his speechwriter, his advisors, they got together and they probably provided this crafted, you know, statement for him. Nothing like what Vice President Pence said. He was more poignant. He was more in your face. He said our democracy has some problems and white supremacy, we need to denounce it at all costs.
And the New York Times echoed a little bit what you just said there, Chad. They used the term President Trump as bowing to pressure in that stronger language, condemning white supremacists and bowing to pressure, if that's an accurate read on it. If you are someone who agrees with that, that seems to be a more reactive instead of proactive. But given all that, this is the president of the United States. Does this message still have power?
I'm not certain if this president's message has power simply because he placates, he ingratiates, and he displays with false generosity. I think the power is within the people. I think the power is what Marco Rubio said and what John McCain said and what the governor said and what good conscience people are saying all over the country with the anti, you know, rallies centered around white supremacy. You saw the whites speaking back to this. We saw individuals on every side of the color line and gender line speaking back to this. And it's just such a blessing to have a format like today on WPR where we're going to have various opinions. But I'm not looking to the president to steer the country in the right direction. I'm going back to what the founding fathers articulated when they said, we the people.
We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter right now, national expert on race relations and a professor at Westchester University, with us to give us analysis of the violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Chad, looking at the election of Barack Obama 8 years ago, some people began to talk then about a post-racial era, but we also saw at that same time some nascent racism emerging, which was surprising to some people, probably not surprising to other people. So what is your take on what Obama's election may have meant for the politics of race in America?
I think at one juncture, it kind of supposed that we were transcending race. On the other extreme, post-racial is still a mirage. I do applaud the president in one sense, even though I provide a critique for the president. I do applaud the president in one sense when he verbalized that some of the behavior that we see was a long, protracted history that didn't have anything to do with him or Barack Obama. But we do know over the past 10 years, 8 years of the Obama administration and the 2 years leading up to the Obama running for president, we saw a lot of mean-spirited behavior, a lot of bigotry, a lot of discrimination, everything from calling Michelle Obama anything but who she is, which is a beautiful woman, not just a black woman, but just a beautiful woman, beautiful women on every side of the color line. And so we saw that type of behavior. And then what Trump did was he emboldened it with the birther claims. He emboldened it with the let's build defense, the xenophobic behavior, white male dominance. His cabinet, for some, was made up of individuals who we say alt-right, but is a white supremacist organization. And so what you say in theory and then what you do with policy, actually, when it converges, people get the real Donald Trump.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Lonnie joining us first in Neillsville. Lonnie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, first off, I do want to denounce the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists for their actions. They were uncalled for, but I'm kind of wondering why there's two sets of standards here, because nobody had a problem when Obama invited the Black Lives Matter to the White House. I mean, they're punks and thugs just like the white supremacists. There was no outcry then. And then when Obama went call out the people in the San Bernardino shootings and the Pulse nightclub as radical Islamist terrorist, how come there was no outcry then?
Lonnie, thank you for the call. Chad.
I think, Lonnie, you raised some really great questions. I think that in our democracy, one thing that we should do is refrain from calling people punks or thugs, just like the president called the white supremacist losers. I don't think we do that. I think when we look at Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter actually was created in defense of some black and brown people being killed by some white police officers with their hands up, no weapons, with impunity, just similar to the historical aspect of the Black Panthers being established, not to take down white supremacy, but to speak back to white supremacy. So in our democracy, we do a lot of this. And I'm not saying, Lonnie, that you strategically try to get on this call with your analysis to do this, but we've kind of mixed apples and oranges. When we look at Black Lives Matter, it was speaking back to the challenges. Anywhere in United States of America, if black and brown people assembled with torches, with weapons, they would call in the National Guard, if not paramilitary force. In Ferguson, this was a peaceful demonstration because of Darren Wilson killing Mike Brown, and you saw a military force. In Charlottesville, you did not see a military force, and therein lies the white privilege that most Americans should be aware of, but we're in denial about.
Chad Dion Lassiter is joining us right now. He's a national expert on race relations and a professor at Westchester University. He's with us now giving us analysis of the violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'd like to hear your reactions to this weekend's events, what you hope to see, fear to see going forward. What do you see happening in the politics of race in the United States? What do you think of political reaction from the president, from senators and others? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our discussion and get to more of your calls in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter, looking into the violence over this weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, after white supremacist protesters clashed with counter-protesters, injuring at least 34 people, leaving one woman dead.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. How is your community reacting to what happened over the weekend? What would you like to see happen at the federal level in response to the violence? And what do you think the weekend says about the politics of race in the United States and where it stands today? You can call us at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take another call now. We've got Mike joining us next in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This thing about race, I remember President Obama's inauguration. I said, oh, good, finally, maybe we're getting rid of it. But then, too, all of a sudden, there was racist acts all over the country. This is not Donald Trump's fault. Pretty much every elected Republican for the past 8 years has been race baiting all the time. Okay? Lazy man. The things they call Michelle Obama. You know, this air that immigrants are taking away from white people, that white people's plight is because of dark people. Let's call it what it is, okay? This isn't Donald Trump.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for that call. And Chad, do you agree on any degree with what Mike had to say? Do you think there has been sort of fanning of the flames of racist resentment in the country? Mike says over the last 8 years.
Oh, yeah. And if you heard me in my before mentioned analysis, I see this as being something that has happened over the past 10 years. I love the passion in which Mike spoke with. I just partially disagree that Donald Trump is part of it. Donald Trump, when he ran on a campaign of xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, divisiveness, white supremacist ideology. He had his pulse on the country. He understood that white male dominance and whiteness in and of itself was being threatened, and that whites, some, had fear that they were going to be the permanent minority, not the permanent underclass, because power still rules our empire. But he's right from the perspective of historically, the challenge has always been in our democracy, this virus, this disease called white supremacy and institutional racism, and we really don't want to face it. I have some problems also with the police in Charlottesville because they actually just stood there and they did not engage in trying to make sure that they, you know, intervene with some of these behaviors. And in the past, we've seen individuals on the other side of color line lose their life to a wallet, to having their hands up with no weapon.
and we've heard the police spokespeople in Charlottesville saying it might not have looked like the police were doing things. You couldn't always tell from the press coverage, but that they were involved in breaking up the struggle there. Do you see that point? Do you see that they might have been doing more than it looked like?
Actually, the people who were on the ground, some of my journalist colleagues in the city of Philadelphia and Chicago, in Detroit, Washington, D.C., articulated to me that from what they witnessed, for those who were on the ground covering the story, they actually did not see the police engaged in the same manner that we've seen them when they were in Ferguson, when they were in Baltimore. And I just don't want to make this one of those things where it's black and white, but also when you see black and white students in Cal Berkeley, you know, saying Black Lives Matter. In China, they're saying Black Lives Matter. And so this notion that we want to give these individuals a pass, one of the things I think we're not exploring is that they weren't just neo-Nazi sympathizers and white supremacists. They also double as counselors, social workers, doctors, firemen, firewomen. And so these are individuals who live in our community.
I want to ask you something, Chad. Is this, we've been talking about the history of this. Do you see this as white supremacy being rebuilt anew from the ground up? Or is this the same lineage of white supremacy that Martin Luther King Jr. was fighting in the civil rights movement?
That's a great question, and I will go out on a limb and simply say I think this is just a new generation of white supremacy. I don't think it has the old playbook where we're looking at, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and hoods and things of that nature and robes. I don't think it's that. I think it's in our policies. I think it's, you know, driving while black. I think it's, you know, not just racism just doesn't impact black and brown people, but white supremacy also disadvantages, you know, whites as well. I think this is a new generation because it's more covert. And so it's in our policies. It's in, you know, the way we run the justice system, the Department of Justice. It's the way we do fair housing. And it's the way we do, you know, business within the police departments. And so it's definitely not what King and his cohort of colleagues on every side of the color line saw. It's something entirely new. This prison industrial complex is worse than it was during King's time. And this military industrial complex is worse as well. And lastly, I would say that the only similarities I see from that era and this era is that when King spoke about the triple evils of poverty, militarism, and racism, it's the same thing that we're faced with here in the 21st century.
Just quickly before we get back to calls, do you see the differences that you just laid out there? Do you see that as making this more difficult to counter or to work with? Or how do you see it? On what level?
I struggle with that. I agonize with that. One of the things I do know is that with the advent of social media, you can mobilize for hate, but you can also mobilize for justice quicker than you could in previous generations and in previous eras. I think it's structural. I think that, you know, we can't get distracted. We should be concerned about Charlottesville. We should be concerned about the two police officers or the two state troopers who lost their lives and the other individual. But we also need to look at this from a structural and institutional standpoint. It's our policies. They can chant all they want, but it's the policies that are damaging our democracy as well.
I want to take Gary next in Rhinelander. Gary, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I definitely do not condone any kind of violence when someone disagrees with another. I just have a little bit of different take, meaning that I believe a lot of this uprising, yes, began or sparked because of the Robert E. Lee statue being taken out of a park, and that the bureaucrats decided to agree with some groups that decided that that was not something that we needed in the parks. And this seems to be something that's been happening over the last several years.
So, Gary, you think it should stay?
Excuse me?
Do you think the statue should stay?
Yes, I do, for one only reason. It's history. It's history of showing, yes, the bigotry as well as racism and such, but it also stands for what we were at one time. Let's get another statue in there that will show, hey, what we are in the year 2020 or where we are today, that what we stand for today.
Gary, thanks a lot for that. And Chad, is there something to that? Do you think that history is not sanitized? It's messy. There are things that we're ashamed of in it. And that doesn't mean that we need to remove it. Do we need to add context like Gary is saying?
I think we should add context. And Gary, if you're still listening, please tweet me at Chad Lassiter. I'd love to keep a conversation going with you. I think Gary is absolutely right, because it's similar to the N-word that runs rampant through Mark Twain. That was part of history. That was part of the Southern, you know, roots during that time. I wouldn't want the N-word to be removed from a classic like Mark Twain. I don't believe we create another statue, but to Gary's point, I think we leave these monuments that some perceive as hate up, and we have a marker that has a teachable moment to teach people something entirely different. Now, I know I may take some flack from that nationally from some of my colleagues on every side of the color line who see the Confederate flag and who see statues, or down at Princeton University, Woodrow Wilson's name is on buildings, and some students did a sit-in with Black Lives Matter. And also there were some Asian and African students as well as Latino students who had a problem with Woodrow Wilson's name being on several buildings down at Princeton University. But I think that those things remain, and we have conversations about them. That was part of the history. But I'm also okay if individuals want to fight to take down Confederate flags and want to remove statues. I just think they serve as, you know, teachable moments, and it tells us about our history.
Thank you so much for that call, Gary. And just briefly, Chad, as we wrap up, CNN is reporting that white nationalists are planning another rally in Texas in September. What do you think states and police and citizens can learn from Charlottesville to face what's coming next?
I think in our democracy, we have to really look at this notion. I'm certainly not an expert in constitutional law, but this whole freedom of speech, and we say that you can hide hate speech behind freedom of speech, I think that becomes a challenge. I think that, and that's what I worry about, you know, is that whole aspect that people can show up and they can say things and they can spew out their bigotry, their racist ideology, their homophobic ideology. This was an act of terrorism. We don't need to humanize the young man who mom articulated that he has one black friend and he drove the car and ended up killing an individual. That was evil. It was an act of terrorism. If it was a Muslim, we would be engaged in all sorts of Islamophobia. But I think for upcoming colleges, they still should have anti-protesters against the rhetoric, and it should be civil. But also we should have a police force there, and we should have some people who do the work of intervention around hostile situations and conflict resolution in the crowd. But I think that when it gets to the point of hate, these type of rallies need to be shut down.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, national expert on race relations and a professor of race relations at Westchester University in Pennsylvania.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.